This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hungary warns that the EU plan to impose a price cap on Russian gas may trigger an immediate cutoff in Russian gas supplies. Thousands of people are told to evacuate in the U.S. state of California as wildfires rage on. And North Korea passes a law allowing it to carry out preventive nuclear strikes and declaring its status as a nuclear-armed state. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Hungary says an EU plan to impose a price cap on Russian gas may trigger an immediate cutoff in Russia's gas supplies. Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó says that the proposal is against European and Hungarian interests. The price cap was announced by the European Commission on Wednesday. EU officials say the move will lower the costs of gas and would enable EU member states to support vulnerable households and companies. The bloc is split on the plan. Power and fuel prices have soared as Russia cut the amount of gas it sends to Europe, with the European leaders accusing Moscow of weaponizing its energy supplies. Russia has blamed the supply cuts on technical issues. Moscow has warned that it will halt supply of oil and gas to countries that impose price caps on the country's energy. Russia's president has delivered a fiery speech prepared with warnings to Europe and the U.S. In his remarks, Putin laid out how the world has gone through irreversible and tectonic shifts. What's clear is that the fallout from the war in Ukraine has laid bare the shortcomings in the West, while Russia is looking for new opportunities in other parts of the world, especially in West Asia and Asia.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Moscow's warnings against the West for its punitive measures against the Kremlin continue to get tough. President Putin has now warned that Western sanctions against his country are hurting the entire world. Putin described the sanctions as short-sighted, saying the West has undermined the global economy with its aggressive attempts to impose its dominance on the world.
The United States has been pressing sanctions against Russia, individuals, private businesses, and state-owned enterprises. The European countries, most of which belong to the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, have gone along with this and have imposed their own sanctions. They're trying to cut back on the importation of Russian gas, because that provides revenue for the Russian government. But they seem to have suddenly remembered that they import 30% of their gas from Russia.
Putin also said the West has been reluctant to recognize that, quote, irreversible and tectonic shifts have occurred in international relations. According to Putin, these shifts in international relations have led to the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a magnet for human resources, capital, and production capacities. The Russian president further said that Moscow found more opportunities in the markets in the Middle East after the West imposed sanctions on Russia. Putin also attributed the unfolding global economic crisis to Western elites who, quote, would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes. He further said the U.S. and its Western allies have tried to isolate Russia, but, according to Putin, it's impossible to isolate Moscow from the global economic and political landscape.
The problem for the United States ruling class at this point is that the world is becoming increasingly multipolar. It's no longer a situation where the United States can call the shots every area politically, economically, and even militarily. China is the second, the world's second largest economy, and is that economy is advancing more rapidly than that of the United States, and the United States views this as a tremendous threat because it's an economic competitor. The United States has been involved in wars throughout its history, but certainly intensely ever since World War II.
The Russian president used that podium in Vladivostok to once again remind Western powers that isolating Russia is something they will never succeed at. He also hailed Russia's strong ties with Asia, which are not restricted to trade, but perhaps one of the most important points he made was that he called Western sanctions a threat to the entire world, while downplaying the impact at home.
The crisis between the West and Russia has triggered unprecedented shifts in international alliances. After the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine, the U.S. and its European allies tried to put Russia into a corner by imposing a raft of sanctions against Moscow. They put Russia's oil and gas industries, as well as its banking and insurance sectors, under heavy sanction. But the sanctions now appear to have backfired against Europe. Following the tensions, oil and gas prices surged to unprecedented levels. The high prices were beneficial to Russia, bringing huge profits to its oil and gas sector. Furthermore, Russia has forged closer ties with China, India, and Iran.
So, and meanwhile, Russia is now selling more oil to China and India at reduced cost, but they're selling it. So it looks like the sanctions are not going to hurt Russia nearly to the extent that the West hoped it would, and they're having repercussions on the standard of living of Europeans and North Americans, which only goes to show how integrated we are into a global economy. The sanctions are not producing the effect that the West wanted to. It's not bringing Russia to its knees, and it is also having deleterious effects on their own economies and their own peoples. So I think in that sense, President Putin was correct in his analysis.
Furthermore, the crisis put European countries into uncharted territory. Gas prices are rising dramatically in Europe following Russia's decision to stop gas exports to Europe. Moscow has cited Western sanctions as the reason for its decision and says it will not resume gas flow until Western sanctions are lifted. The energy crunch is now hurting European countries. There are now warnings of a harsh winter in Europe. There are already protests in several European countries against high costs of living and soaring prices. High electricity prices are hurting ordinary citizens in Europe as well as major businesses. Germany, which is considered Europe's biggest economy, is now on the brink of recession. Experts now warn that an economic downturn in Germany is unavoidable. And the recession in Germany will surely negatively affect the economy of the entire European Union.
Firefighters in the U.S. are struggling to gain control of wildfires across the state of California as a seemingly endless heat wave persists in the region. A blaze that started burning on Monday outside the city of Los Angeles has expanded in two directions in western and eastern California and almost doubled in size in the past 24 hours. Thousands of people have been forced to evacuate the area, and two people have been killed. Officials say the fire has now engulfed more than 7,700 hectares, and only five of the wildfires have been contained. Another wildfire is also growing rapidly in the north of California, forcing thousands of others out of their homes. North Korea has passed a law which officially declares the country as a nuclear weapons state. According to the state media, the new law outlines the country's nuclear policies, under which it will rule out any negotiations over Pyongyang's denuclearization. Also, the country will not distribute or share nuclear arms with other countries or transfer nuclear technology or materials. The North Korean leader has described the new status as irreversible. Pyongyang's legislation comes amid signs that the country has completed preparations to conduct a new nuclear test. Tehran rejects anti-Iran accusations made by Persian Gulf Arab countries in the final communique of the 153rd ministerial meeting of the GCC. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nessa Kanani says the three islands of Abu Musa, the Greater and the Lesser Tums, eternally belong to Iran. He says the biggest factor contributing to instability in the region are the U.S. and Israel. The spokesman says that it is regrettable that the GCC members have once again voiced anti-Iran rhetoric instead of correcting their failed policies. The GCC statement stressed the need to address, quote, Iran's destabilizing behavior in the region. They also rejected what they call Iran's occupation of the three islands of Greater Tumb, of the Lesser Tumb, and Abu Musa. The U.S. says it has imposed sanctions on several Iranian companies over what it calls Tehran's sales of drones to Russia. The U.S. Treasury Department says one of the targeted companies coordinated the shipping of Iranian drones to Russia. Three other firms were allegedly involved in the research, development, and production of Iranian military drones. Washington also warned non-Iranian companies against being involved in Iran's drone trade. The U.S. says Iran has sold Russia hundreds of drones to be used in the Ukraine war. Both Iran and Russia deny this. On Thursday, Russia demanded the U.S. to provide evidence supporting its claim that Russia seeks drones from Iran to use in Ukraine. A disturbing trend of violent anti-Muslim attacks has rocked the English city of Leicester over the past few months, as local claim radicalized Hindus are roaming the streets on a weekly basis, hunting down vulnerable Muslims and assaulting them. Leicester, which boasts a sizable Asian community, has witnessed a number of assaults with Muslims failing victims to indictments. Robert Carter reports.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, we've informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs, radicalized by foreign extremism.
At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community.
Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs. This mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least three severe attacks have occurred, with at least two victims being hospitalized. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Queen Elizabeth II, who reigned for more than 70 years as Britain's monarch, has died at the age of 96, with her son Charles now succeeding her as king. In a statement, the Buckingham Palace has announced 10 days of mourning. It says the king and the queen consort will remain at the royal house in Balmoral, Scotland, before returning to London on Friday. The national flags at Windsor Castle and other government buildings have been lowered to half-mast after the queen's death was officially announced on Thursday afternoon. Officials, including newly appointed Prime Minister Liz Truss, mourn the passing of the monarch.
We are all devastated by the news that we have just heard from Balmoral. The death of Her Majesty the Queen is a huge shock to the nation and to the world. Queen Elizabeth II was the rock on which modern Britain was built.
Truss said the Queen had been a personal inspiration to her and many other Britons, adding that Britain grew and flourished under her reign. World leaders have also paid tribute to the Queen and expressed condolences, that is, to the British royal family over her demise. Elizabeth was the longest-serving monarch in British history. Her reign began in February 1952. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to tell us more about the challenges that the new British monarch will face after ascending the throne.
Charles is really getting on in age, and you don't know, I mean, this family has quite an age longevity, of course, as we know, but how long will his reign last? Will he be able to make that kind of impact? He's also, don't forget, now presiding over a very different kind of Britain that's emerging. What with all of the energy crisis and the world in flux as we see it around the globe today, Britain is also going to have to find its own way with the Brexit scenarios, with the relationships with China and America, etc., to balance the war in Ukraine. He's coming into a world which is probably equally fraught. I mean, the Queen herself came at the tail end of the Second World War, of course, and he's also going to have to deal with a complete change in the type of society that we're living in, the information age and the biotechnological age, the age of transhumanism, the age of, if you like, all sorts of modern technological advances will have its own challenges.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
In the limelight.
Syria, Russia, Iran, and also China have condemned the looting of the Syrian people's wealth by the American occupation forces and demanded firm measures to prevent the smuggling of this country's oil abroad. Experts believe the continued stealing of Syrian oil by the United States is the main cause of the difficult humanitarian situations that Syrian citizens are suffering from. They say the looting of Syrian oil by Washington has reached its highest level, and this issue has caused the continuation of the dire humanitarian situations because millions of Syrian people suffer from lack of energy, food, water, and other essential materials. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The Global Times wrote, recently the U.S. conducted fresh rounds of airstrikes in Syria, and meanwhile, its efforts to steal Syria's oil have come to a new high. The U.S. wants to be the world's police, but its practices expose that the country is merely a global hooligan, bully, and robber. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, the U.S. occupation forces on Monday, August 29th, brought out 123 tankers loaded with Syrian oil from Al Jazeera fields toward Iraqi lands. The report said that the U.S. occupation forces on August 21st transported a convoy of 137 tankers filled with stolen oil to their bases in Iraq. On August 8, the Syrian oil ministry said that the U.S. and its mercenaries were stealing an average of 66,000 barrels of oil per day in Syria, about 80% of Syria's daily oil production. As a matter of fact, the U.S. has been stealing Syria's oil for several years, but now in the context of factors such as the ongoing Ukraine crisis, holding oil prices near their highest levels in years, the U.S. can gain far more from stealing Syria's oil. Tian Wenlin, a research fellow at the China Institute of Contemporary International Relations, told the Global Times, "In this way, the U.S. also wants to weaken the incumbent Syrian government economically," adding, "By doing so, Washington hopes to use resources obtained in war to support that war and Takfiri terrorists, to sustain its military operations and expenditures in Syria and even the entire West Asia. As oil is a major pillar of Syria's economy, by stealing it, the U.S. is actually attempting to worsen West Asian countries' economy and undermine local people's livelihoods. But to a larger degree, the U.S. violations of Syria's sovereignty and plundering of West Asian countries' resources are for the sake of its own interest, that is, to advance more economic gains." The Modern Diplomacy website said the prolonged crisis in Syria has cost Syria's oil sector about $105 billion in direct and indirect losses. One might say that stealing Syria's oil is being done in order to impoverish the Syrian people so much so that they will turn against and overthrow Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, whom even Western-sponsored polls, which have been taken for years in Syria, have shown to be overwhelmingly the one person whom they want to be Syria's president. However, whatever the reason might be as to why the U.S. regime is stealing Syria's oil, the U.S. regime theft is equally illegal and equally a gangster operation. That is, it is running there. This operation has been going on for a decade now under American presidents Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and currently Joe Biden. President Trump ordered the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Syria in December 2018, but the Pentagon would not agree with the order, and the U.S. troops remain in two locations, one in the oil-rich northeast region and the other in southeast at Tanf. What does Washington truly care about in West Asia? Democracy, human rights, or good governance? The answer is none of these, but the access to resources such as oil. The chaos in the region can help the U.S. seize more natural resources and show its influence. Washington's recent airstrikes towards Syria and theft of its oil are a vivid demonstration that it is greed and interest that have dominated U.S. diplomacy, not democracy and good governance, as it has always claimed. For many years, the U.S. has launched countless wars in countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, under the banner of countering terrorism. It now appears that those counterterrorism operations are perhaps a tool to serve U.S. interest. Washington's talk of counterterrorism is only an empty one because, judging from the results, the U.S. and the rest of the world have not become safer. Instead, more chaos was brought to them because of Washington's so-called war on terror. Moreover, China daily has lambasted the continued plundering of the Syrian oil by U.S. occupation forces across the Arab countries, saying that the looting is a disgrace and a shame to Washington. The Daily made the assertion in an article published recently following reports that the convoy, consisting of more than 100 U.S. military tankers, had carried thousands of liters of crude oil from the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka to the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region in northern Iraq. Stressing that the matter shows the U.S. greedy appetite for oil is still not satisfied, the paper said it is easy to understand the fact that U.S. troops steal oil from Syria, as theft has long been their profession. Yet it is rather informative that the U.S. troops transported their stolen oil to Iraq, which is, in the general impression of the public, a country rich in oil. The top Chinese newspaper pointed out that the theft always reflects negatively on the people of the countries whose resources are stolen by the United States, underlining Iraq's high rates of poverty despite the country's richness in oil and other natural assets. The paper said despite being the fifth largest oil producer of the world, much of Iraq's population is still living in poverty, adding there might be many reasons, but pillaging by the U.S. is one of them. There have been many reports of the U.S. having seized and shipped gold out of the country. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. However, Damascus maintains the deployment is meant to plunder the country's rich mineral resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on more than one occasion that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has not been subservient to the U.S. and has not become a vassal state. This explains why Iran's leader has hailed the Islamic Republic as the most promising force in the face of plots pursued by colonial powers, stating that most of their outrageous demands have been resisted and rejected due to Iran's resistance. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kinds of demands the leader was talking about and why those demands and pressures have failed. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille in France. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sam Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Sam Mohsen Abbas, first to you. One of the things that Iran's leader has said, Shia Muslims take great pride in standing up against arrogant powers which interfere in the affairs of other countries, governments, and nations in a cruel and tyrannical manner. Can you expand that for us, please?
Well, lying at the heart of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, is an ideology, and this is what quite often both Western analysts, as well those Western analysts who are antagonistic towards Iran, and Western politicians and Western media very conveniently forget, that the Islamic Revolution was based on not only bringing down the arrogant powers as manifested by the Shah of Iran, but it's also based on some fundamental values, the values of justice, the values of courage, and the values of fairness. These are just some of the values which, of course, Islam, which is at the heart of the Islamic Revolution's ideological stand, insists upon. And the leadership of Imam Khomeini, followed by the guidance of Rehbere Mukawama, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has kind of consolidated around these fundamental values. And when Ayatollah Khamenei therefore talks about the enmity of the arrogant powers, what he's talking about is a fundamental flaw in the system that lies certainly in the West. And that flaw is based on the lack of virtues, and the key one he picks out there is arrogance. And it is this arrogance which leads the West to try and subjugate Iran, which is its primary objective, by any means necessary. So subjugating Iran, of course, means economically, politically, ideologically. And they go about doing it through military means, through economic sanctions, and they've tried it through psychological operations, cultural wars. All of it has been rolled out, and we can go into more of the details of how that's been done.
Sure.
And I think this is what Ayatollah Khamenei is talking about, that Iran's defense against that constant attack from all different forms has been a very successful one.
Okay. When we take a look at the way that Iran is actually viewed, Elijah Magnier, by the West, and in particular the U.S., obviously the U.S. has problems with Iran and what it stands for. Taking a close look, however, at what Iran stands for is not something that is out of the ordinary or is something outrageous. We're looking at, again, some of the statements made today, another which is about standing up to bullying, where Iran's leader described Iran's encouragement of other nations to stand up against bullying as the main reason behind what he said was arrogant powers, wrath, and enmity towards the Islamic Republic. What types of things do you think Iran's leader is talking about when he says standing up to bullying?
Well, actually, the Americans really don't care about the religion in Iran or in any other country, and they really are careless about the Sunni or the Shia or any other religion. They are mainly concerned about the country that is submitted to the U.S. hegemony or not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. And Iran, since 1979, showed that it is rejecting the U.S. or any other hegemony, even the Russian or any other country that is trying to impose its will on the Iranian population. So from that on, from that period onward, for America, Iran become an enemy state, or a state to be you have to be breaked and bring to submission, and Iran should kneel to the American hegemony of the world. Particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, Iran remained with a very few countries like Cuba, and after that, many years later, Venezuela, who are rejecting the U.S. hegemony. So from that on, the Americans constructed 35 military bases around Iran in different countries in the Gulf. They even pushed Saddam Hussein to attack Kuwait through the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad. And they attack Iraq to cripple Iraq, but at the end of the day, to be on the border with Iran, because the aim was to submit Iran after Syria and Lebanon. So this is how the Americans understand how countries should function, and countries should function according to the U.S. policy and putting the U.S. Priority above any other priorities, including the national security of any country. We've seen this today happening in Europe. So it is not surprising that the Americans consider Iran as an enemy. The only thing that the Americans want from Iran is just to accept it in Germany, and then Iran can be the leader of all the nations in the Middle East, and that would be extremely happy for the Americans to do, as long as Iran submit to the Americans. And we've seen today with the nuclear deal, Iran is showing that its national interests come first and not the U.S. hegemony.
So following that train of thought, Saim Hossein Abbas, we're looking at the fact that the U.S. Throughout the decades since the Islamic Revolution has not been able to obviously make Iran subservient to its foreign policy objectives, particularly in this region. And it has gone to, and it has subscribed to something that has really reared an ugly head way back. And it showed itself back in 2003, particularly, and that's the whole issue of sectarianism when the U.S. waged a war against Iraq. Tell us the way that the U.S. used that card. And how? What kind of function did Iran have in that to basically defeat the consequences that arose out of that U.S. push?
Well, this notion of a Shia crescent popped up quite early on in this century, perhaps even slightly before. And initially, it was the Jordanians and the Arabs who were aligned to the Americans who started pushing this idea of a Shia crescent. And that was the first time one heard of this kind of new narrative that was being pushed out ultimately by American intelligence agencies and all those that were allied to them. And it was really designed to create a fear, first of all, amongst Sunnis. So there was this sectarian effort to divide the Middle East along Shia and Sunni lines. And they went for it, and they still continue to go for it. It's, of course, it's kind of most vicious and venomous manifestations, of course, are Daesh and ISIS, who are well known across the world now to have been a kind of head-cutting, very ruthless, very nasty phenomena, which was actually on the verge of bringing Iraq down. It was certainly operating and still is operating to bring Syria down. It still is doing the same with Iraq. Those are just two theaters of its operation. Afghanistan, I could quote, perhaps even Libya and Yemen as well. But primarily, it's Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, its support of Hezbollah and its support of Assad in Syria, its support of Iraq in terms of trying to make sure that it has sovereignty, or these nations or these regions have their own sovereignty, which has actually prevented the American plots and plans to use Daesh, to use ISIS as a means of breaking the region. But at the heart of it was ISIS was handed an ideology. It was handed a kind of very extreme, very violent version of Wahhabism, which originates, of course, in those same Arab states which are propped up by the Americans and who are supported by them, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, you know, all of these central nations which all supported this nasty virus known as Daesh. But, of course, it's failed, largely because of the military actions of the Al-Quds force, and many other reasons. But the Iranians have also countered with their own, of course, ability to be able to show people that there's another way, and the way is a successful model of Velayat-e Faqih, a successful model of Iran, which can actually challenge the hegemony.
Well, taking a look at this sectarian card, Elijah Magnier, it seems like something that they went for was the fact that they wanted to use sectarian tensions to ultimately try to divide the two, Sunnis and Shias, and to form an ethnic mapping, of which we heard that echoed by the now U.S. president, but former VP of the U.S., Joe Biden, when he went for the partition of Iraq. Is that was that a concerted effort by the U.S. to ultimately partition Iraq, as stated in the past by then VP of the U.S., Biden?
When the Americans failed to confront Iran and its allies in the Middle East, therefore it was in need of another enemy that can fight Iran and can fight all the allies of Iran without the U.S. interfering in the middle of the battle, but supplying from behind and allowing groups to fight each other by triggering the reason behind that. So the problem in the Twelvers is they stand against injustice. And the Sunnis in general, they obey to the rulers. By having a group of people who stand against injustice, they are extremely dangerous, because what the Americans are bringing to the Middle East is they are bringing dominance, and they're bringing death and destruction and control. This is what they've done in Afghanistan for 20 years. This is what they've done in Iraq. And then in Iraq, they have failed. So the only way is to turn the Shia and the Sunni against one another. And we've seen in Iraq how the Shia resisted for many years not to respond to the extremist Sunni, who are not really Sunni, but they have a particular ideology that was exploited by the Americans. I remember Colin Powell saying that they have boosted the image of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who lived in Kurdistan before 2003, under the control of the U.S. forces. So they were very much aware of the weight of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, what he represented, and they inflated him because they needed him to confront the Shia. And this is what they've done in Syria, by trying to blur the real narrative by saying that it is a sectarian war, when 70% of the Syrian army are Sunni fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And then we suddenly see, to prove the fake narrative of the Americans, that they claim it is Sunni Shia, when we've seen ISIS attacking Al-Qaeda, and they're both Sunni, both Wahhabis, and they both believe more or less in the same doctrine. So all this excuse by the Americans to bring the Islamophobia or the Shia phobia, or to bring the Sunni and the Shia together, has only one aim. It's a political aim, it's not a religious aim. But they found grounds for that, and they supported, and they throw oil on fire, and they found who can listen to them, particularly when we see how the Americans supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, to understand that the objective of the Americans is not to defeat the extremists, but to support them as long as they serve their own objectives and purposes.
Well, it's very interesting the way that the whole approach of the U.S., Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, has been towards the terrorists that are Sunni. And I'm going to read off what I found to be something that was echoed on numerous sites. This one is from the Atlantic Council, in a report where it said, U.S. made Iran the U.S.'s top priority in the Middle East, allowing for America's great big counter-Sunni extremist machine. Now notice, it doesn't call them, the U.S. doesn't call them terrorists. It calls them Sunni extremist machine, to shift focus to Shia groups. And it goes on to say, Iranian-backed Shia militant groups have begun to be sanctioned more regularly, even those that had fought against Daesh. Now, can you believe that? It says the Shia groups who are fighting against Daesh, they're still terrorists. Can you please explain the logic there?
Well, there is no logic there. As we've recognized, that America has a very one-sided and very single-minded objective. It is to crush the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership and its kind of governance structures until it actually does what America says, until it hands over its wealth, it hands over its sovereignty, hands over all of its kind of autonomy. The Americans and the Israelis, for that matter, won't rest. And of course, you know, it's not just the card of the Shia Sunni that they've tried to play, because of course they know that Islamic Republic of Iran is predominantly Shia, although there's a very peaceful Sunni minority that lives in that region. There's a peaceful Jewish minority that lives there as well. But what they've tried to do is isolate Iran and try to create a propaganda that Iran is Shia, and it can never therefore be a leader of the Islamic world or the Western Asia, because it's fundamentally religiously different. Although the differences between the Shia and Sunni are absolutely minuscule in reality. Anybody who knows anything about religious depths knows that that's a fallacy to create that kind of level of division. But they've also used the Arab non-Arab card, don't forget. And with, again, Iranians and the whole notion of Persia and whatever, they've tried to also use that to accentuate the difference of Iranians from the Arabs. They've tried to create intra-Shia conflicts, as you talked about, intra-Sunni conflicts and the wars that have been going on between those groups and the parties. I mean, Libya was not a Shia-Sunni crisis. Again, it had a completely different dynamic. Syria was nothing to do with that. But this intra-Shia fighting, they've sponsored certain groups within Iran and outside Iran. Imam Khamenei has said very clearly that British Shiism, i.e. Western manufactured Shiism or religious ideology, is also a factor. And they use this largely as a psychological operation, you know, using the media. This is very, very, they're very clever at this. The US satellite media has hundreds and hundreds of propaganda platforms to advertise against Iran, to pump up the public against the Islamic Republic of Iran, to say that it's failing, that it isn't able to handle itself in a sort of a civilized way. This is all part of the propaganda that's also been going on. They've used every means necessary to try and really isolate Iran in that sense.
Well, that's the whole thing that Iran's leader was also talking about, in addition to what we've covered, Elijah Magnier, and that's the whole notion of Iranophobia. Of course, that's been going on for quite some time. But it's interesting the way that the U.S., if you can expand on this for us, if you agree, has created this Iranophobia as a tool to generate money. We know that the U.S. is always after vilifying a country, and, well, Iran's been on that list, maybe in the number one spot for quite some time. We're in the region, Iranophobia through the U.S. has generated billions of dollars in military sales. Doesn't that hold true?
Yes, it is true, because creating Iranophobia with the support of the countries of the Middle East, particularly the Gulf countries, the U.S. has succeeded in implementing this Iranophobia in the leadership among the Arabs to push them to buy more weapons and to allow more military bases in the country. So this is how the Americans managed to implant military bases around Iran, under the excuse of Iran creating a danger, potential danger, when Iran never attacked any Arab country since 1979. So if we look, I mean, we should not be surprised here in the West to look at Iran supporting the Palestinian Sunni in Gaza, supporting the Syrian and President Assad, where the majority are Sunni, supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting Iraq, and particularly when General Qasem Soleimani first supported the Kurds in Kurdistan, and then the Sunnis in Al-Anbar, and the Shia in the south and in Baghdad, and then supporting the people in Venezuela. So we understand that Iran has gone beyond the religion, and that is extremely dangerous to the American objective and plans in the world. Today, the Americans are fighting the Russian and the Chinese for their hegemony. So Iran is standing in the way, giving an example for the last 43 years. And this is how the Americans managed to create this fear among the Arabs, to tell them that the Iranians are expansionists, and they are expanding to other countries, and they will come and take your country. It is not possible, because this is only a fool person can believe that, because the Americans tried to occupy Afghanistan and they have 1,800,000 soldiers, and they failed. They tried to occupy Iraq and they have failed. They tried to occupy Syria, again they failed. They went with the multinational forces in the 80s in Lebanon and they were kicked out. So no country can go and invade another country and be able to occupy the entire country and stay there forever. So this Iranian phobia has been also used by the Gulf country leaders to support the Americans and buy their weapons so they can keep the danger of the American away from them.
Thank you, Saeed Mohsen Abbas from London, there, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Marseille, France, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having us.
How do you do?
I'm good, thank you.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
The honor and pleasure is all mine. We've been talking about the Arba'in Walk and the significance of this movement and how it serves the walkers, the pilgrims, the Zuwar, spiritually, physically, mentally, psychologically, and the greater picture, the bigger picture and the greater purpose that is almost like the philosophy. I mean, we can't understand the absolute philosophy of everything, especially in religion, but perhaps one of the deepest philosophies of this is to really try to enrich ourselves with the knowledge and ma'rifah toward Imam al-Hussein's movement, right? I think every dimension of Arba'in is such a great manifestation of that. The struggles, the worries, the anxiety, the pain, and that spiritual elation you get. You're so elevated and you're so light, and you carry that with you for like a whole lot, long while afterwards. So that's what we've been talking about with Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. So do you guys have like the last, what is the most recent statistic you have of people walking on Arba'in?
I've heard 25 million.
25 mil, right?
I don't know. I'm a bit skeptical about that, but I don't
know. Until last year, the statistics that the Atabe gave was
around... last year was a pandemic Arba'in.
Yeah, it was around 15.
Last year, I mean, like mid-pandemic and it was 15.
Yeah, it was around the 15 mark.
Right.
Yeah, but usually...
But the years before that,
it gets up to 25.
It would be interesting to know how they count it. Is that 25 altogether within the 10, 15 days, or is it, how does it work?
So what they do is,
So if they say 25 just at the Iran-Iraq border, I'd still believe that.
Because when Karbala itself, like the entry points to Karbala, they do estimates, I think. They don't have a specific
method. Yeah, but what's
the
population of Karbala? Can it even hold 25 people?
Karbala itself? It can't.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think in total,
I think it includes people on the way.
No, but what happens is, like, you got to keep in mind, like, Arba'in, it's like there are people coming and people going.
Exactly.
They're
exactly.
not always at the same
exactly.
time.
So it's mobile.
So especially with the Iraqis, I think this is the Iraqis, something that Iraqis are doing. For them, they do the Arba'in like a day or 2 days prior to the Arba'in itself to make way for the Zuwar.
I've actually met people going back when we're going towards
exactly.
Zuwar, right?
Yeah. So there's a constant, it's like
flow. It's a flow, basically. It's
a
river.
People coming and people going. So you're not having people stuck at the same place, because that would be just literally impossible. And I think I was there one of the years where it was just a standing halt. Like nothing was moving. There was so much people, nothing actually was moving. So, and then they started creating that kind of flow now. So, yeah. So it can carry 20 million people, because most people, they come, they do the ziyarah and they leave. So,
but I think in terms of a global event, I don't think there's anything that matches that. Even if you take it over 10, 15 days,
it broke all records.
25 million people.
Records, yeah.